And with that request, sir, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Robert Borquez, registration number 19577, appearing on behalf of the defendant appellant Janet Alvarado, who appeals the judgment of conviction entered against her on two counts of first degree assault. And although we've briefed several issues in our opening brief, I want to focus this morning on the two instructional errors, the errors in the giving of the flight instruction over the defendant's objection, and the error in refusing to give the multiple assailant instruction as requested by defense counsel. Unless the panel has any questions, I would just rely on what's in our briefs on the other two issues. Regarding the flight instruction, trial court gave a flight instruction at the request of the prosecution over the defense objection. There are two points I wanted to make about that right off the bat, and particularly about the preservation of this issue. Trial counsel lodged an objection to the flight instruction, and before going into any grounds for that objection, the trial court said that, and I'm quoting the trial court, it said, "I certainly understand why defense counsel would object. It will be given." The better practice would have been for defense counsel to go into reasons for the objection, elaborate on that. But it's our position, Your Honors, that given the objection that was lodged, coupled with the trial court's acknowledgement that it understood the reasons, that that was adequate to preserve the issue for review here today. One of the cases cited by the people in their answer brief is the Martinez case. And in it, our Supreme Court explained why vague and unspecific objections are not recognized on appeal. And that's because they fail to call the trial court's attention to the alleged error. Well, in this case, the trial court's acknowledgement indicates that the trial court understood the grounds for the objection. The other point I wanted to make on this issue is that even if the people are correct, and this is limited to plain error review, which we don't concede, but I'm going to address it anyway. The case law in Colorado has been clear since the 1970s that flight instructions are looked on with disfavor. And the Larson case, I think, is instructive. In Larson, the Supreme Court said that it was not error to give, it was not reversible error to give the flight instruction under the circumstances in that case, because amongst other things, in Larson, the defendant was fleeing to avoid or to frustrate apprehension. Larson was a case involving an armed robbery where Mr. Larson and his wife were basically in driving the getaway car. It's pretty clear in Larson that they were trying to avoid apprehension and arrest. Our case is different. In Alvarado, my client wasn't fleeing to avoid arrest. She was fleeing because, as she testified, she was facing three people being beaten up by them. I believe her testimony, and it's summarized in our opening brief in the statement of facts on page 10. She said that she was on the ground, she was being kicked by three people, and she was frightened. That's different than fleeing to avoid apprehension.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Borquez, if I may, please.
Certainly.
I understand that that's your position, and I understand that that was her testimony, but isn't there also an inference that she was fleeing to avoid the police? If she were, as the prosecution contended, the initial aggressor, isn't that a reasonable inference from the evidence?
That's one possible inference, Your Honor, but we believe that the fact that the complaining witnesses, the alleged victims in this case, knew my client, they knew her name, and they knew where to find her. She wasn't fleeing to frustrate apprehension. I think that's different than Larson, where you had basically the drivers of the getaway car in an armed robbery. Here we have people who knew each other, so we think that the facts do not support that.
Well, it's not your position that the Larson factors weren't met here, is it?
It is our position that one of the Larson factors weren't met here. The last factor was, and that he, or in this case she, fled or concealed herself for any length of time to frustrate apprehension. I think that some of the other factors may have been present, Your Honor. All right. The identity of my client was certainly known.
Well, if she fled before the arrival of the police, how is that Larson factor not met?
She fled because, as she testified at trial, Your Honor, it was 3-1, and she was frightened.
Well, I understand that's her position. But as my colleague has pointed out, certainly there is evidence here that would support an inference that she fled to avoid the police.
Well, the police would have been able to track her down easily. She wasn't hiding. The victims in this case knew my client. They knew where she lived. They had a connection to her. In fact, they invited her to the party earlier in the day. I think that came out. Question was whether she overstayed her welcome, but at any rate, we believe that the fourth factor in Larson was not present, and therefore it was not an appropriate instruction to give under these facts. The other thing I wanted to say about the flight instruction is that it unduly emphasizes one piece of evidence. And in this case, there was multiple inferences that could have been drawn from that. If there are no other questions about the flight instruction issue, I'd like to address the other issue. Okay. Regarding the failure to give the multiple assailant instruction that was tendered by the defense, I wanted to address, first of all, people claim that this was invited error. And they claim it was invited error because trial counsel for Ms. Alvarado submitted a package of instructions related to self-defense. I think there were three instructions, and they were marked as tendered but rejected, and they're in the record. But counsel came in and asked for all of those. I believe those were his words at the instructions conference. He was asking the court to give everything. If the court was inclined not to give everything that was requested, in the alternative, he was asking for a Jones instruction or an apparent necessity instruction. That does not constitute invited error. This would have only been invited error, Your Honors, if the trial judge had given all three of the proposed defendants' instructions on self-defense. And later on, Ms. Alvarado claimed on appeal that it was error to give those instructions as requested. That would have been invited error. As for the substance of this claim, the majority opinion in Riley held that a multiple assailant instruction is not necessary in every case. I think we've got that. We start with that. But at the same time, the case law in Colorado is clear that a trial court is obligated to give instructions which are correct statements of the law and which adequately cover all of the issues presented in the case. And it's our position that in Alvarado, this was insufficient to address all of the issues presented.
Mr. Borka, wasn't the instruction that was tendered to the jury here the exact instruction that was approved in Riley?
I believe it was, but the facts in our case are a little different than Riley, if I can get into that. The facts in our case are more analogous to the facts in the Jones case. In Riley, it's my understanding that Mr. Riley was involved in a verbal incident in a store with two other individuals, a man by the name of Velasquez and a woman by the name of Peelman. I believe they were brother and sister. And there was a verbal exchange that escalated. And at one point, one of the, I don't know if it was Velasquez or Peelman, but one of them told the other to go to the truck and get the heat, which Mr. Riley inferred meant a weapon. The incident moved outside of the store onto the sidewalk, I presume, outside, or in the parking lot outside the store. Our case is different because we didn't have two assailants. We had four. Excuse me, we had three. We had Ms. Lopez, we had Mr. Valdez, and we had Mr. Abeda. Jones involved four assailants. And Jones was more similar to our case because Jones took place not on a public street or in a public parking lot with two assailants, but it was Mr. Jones went to Mr. Frisco's place of business. Frisco operated a car dealership, I believe. And apparently he went back to where work was being done on a vehicle and confronted Mr. Frisco and faced three other assailants. Our case is more analogous to Jones as far as the number of assailants was more critical in our case. It does not appear to have been as critical in the Riley case. So that's the distinction we're making.
But if I understand the record correctly, below defense counsel argued that my client faced multiple assailants, and it was clear that there was wasn't there also a theory of the case instruction that said defendant faced multiple assailants?
In Alvarado, Your Honor?
Yes.
I think that trial counsel did not submit a theory of defense, but he did submit a multiple assailant instruction.
Okay. But it was argued, right?
I think there's a difference, Your Honor, between hearing it come from the bench and hearing a lawyer argue it, because it carries more weight when it comes from the bench.
I understand your point, but when we combine Riley and the instruction in Riley with the fact that defense counsel was able at trial to argue multiple assailants without being restricted in that, I'm not seeing the prejudice. So could you help me with that, please?
Okay, certainly, Your Honor. It's our position, first of all, this was not a case of overwhelming evidence of guilt. We had four participants on the patio. All of them had, to various degrees, credibility problems. Their stories did not mesh with one another. They had been drinking and doing cocaine during the course of the day, various amounts. Ms. Lopez said that she didn't drink much. Mr. Abeda said she and her father were drinking all day. Mr. Valdez was biased in that he was related to Ms. Lopez, and you could expect he's going to back up his daughter. Mr. Abeda admitted that he lied to the police. Ms. Lopez admitted she still had feelings for her ex, who was now involved with my client. These people, none of the four had stellar credibility. So it was not a case of overwhelming evidence of guilt. So this was the heart of my client's defense theory, Your Honor, that it was multiple assailants and that she was frightened, and that's why she behaved the way she did. So to get back to your prejudice question, I think that the failure to instruct on a key part of the theory of defense is error in this case. I don't know if that answered your question.
It's okay, thanks.
Okay. If there are no other questions, I would reserve the 2 minutes I have, or 2 minutes and 40 seconds, for a rebuttal.
All right, Mr. Borges, you've got about 2 minutes and 38 seconds.
Thank you.
May it please the court, John First for the people. I'll start with the where we left off, the apparent necessity instruction, and it is our position that this was invited error. The counsel said, and I'm quoting, "Obviously, I'm asking for everything, but in the alternative, I think I either get the Jones instruction or the apparent necessity instruction." In other words, he's saying either course is good for us, and strategically we understand. I mean, counsel acknowledged Riley below, and that, you know, under Riley, one or the other is adequate. And he got, the defense below got their alternative. Certainly wasn't error.
Counsel, isn't it a fair argument, though, for counsel to say, I want all of it, I think I'm entitled to all of it, but if you're not going to give me all of it in the alternative, I would like this? Isn't that a fair argument for counsel to make?
Absolutely, but by submitting an alternative, Your Honor, he's saying, in essence, that's enough for us. That's all.
Is that really what it's saying? That's enough, or that's, I'll take that if I can't get it all.
Well,
isn't there a difference?
I mean, Judge, I see your point, but you know, I think by the way that it was presented to the court, I think that either was acceptable.
Thank you.
Doesn't the question get preserved for appeal simply by tendering the instruction?
You know, there's cases that go both ways. And there is case law that says you've got to, just presenting the instruction doesn't do it. You've got to make the argument.
Well, in the context of invited error, it seems to me, and tell me where I'm wrong, it seems to me that you tend to your instruction. It's hard to say that you're inviting error for the court to reject that instruction.
Well, Your Honor, I guess I see a distinction between inviting the error and preserving the error. And here, I mean, by asking for the alternative, he invited the court to give one or the other. He got what he asked for. So in that sense, he invited the error. Whether it preserved the error is a different question.
I'm sorry, Mr. First, no, but one more question along that line. It strikes me that the argument that this was simply a submission of alternatives and I'm fine with either is one that needs to be made more specifically for us to call this invited error. If trial counsel indeed had said, I'm fine with either, doesn't matter to me, whatever you want to do, that's okay, then that's invited error. But the statement, I want it all, but in the alternative, I'll take less, goes back to Judge Nieto's point. And I think that that point is pretty clearly that this was a tiered argument. First tier, everything I give you, but if you don't want to give me that, then something less. Isn't that simply good advocacy? And aren't we, if we claim, describe this as invited error, aren't we really undercutting what is basically good advocacy?
Under these circumstances, no, Your Honor. Under these circumstances, the way it was presented, because what I don't recall is whether the court had rejected both, or rejected the initial position. If that's the case, then the tiered argument, the tiered advocacy has some applicability here. But it's my, according to what I have here, my recollection of the record, this counsel was right out of the gate with this. So with this alternative argument, not necessarily a tiered argument. So I think the record would be the determining factor there on whether this was a tiered argument or, in our position, whether it was alternative right up front. And you know, the tiered argument, I'm not sure how much sense that makes here because of Riley. Riley had come out. Riley was controlling. So counsel understood that under Riley, he didn't get both.
Well, but counsel is still free to make an argument that Riley was wrongly decided and that we should return to a Jones world. And if he wanted to do that, to preserve that, to submit it eventually to the Supreme Court, that's his business, isn't it?
Of course. But unless there are other questions on the standard of review, as the court has pointed out, recognized, I mean, the instruction here was identical to the instruction in Riley. And distinction here is that the number of assailants makes a difference. That wasn't a distinction in Riley. I mean, the salient point here is the instruction allowed the jury to consider deal with a reasonable person under similar conditions and circumstances, as the court has acknowledged. Counsel argued not only an opening statement but closing argument that there were multiple assailants without objection, without limitation by the court. One point I'd like to make is that in the brief, defendant argues that there was another aspect of the instructions, and that is that the self-defense instruction itself used the singular of victim. Footnote 5 of Riley rejects that argument by saying, and I don't have a page number, but it was footnote 5, and the basis for rejecting that argument is that the victim, the singular, can also be used to be in the plural. And in the context of the instructions as a whole, there was no error. I mean, there was no confusion. And again, like the multiple assailant instruction, the flight instruction is identical to the instruction in Larson. I mean, that's using flight as...
Counsel, before you get into your argument, do you respond to the argument that these are generally disfavored and that under the circumstances of this case where she was known to these people and really didn't have much chance of hiding and avoiding apprehension, that it was inappropriate to give the flight instruction?
Your Honor, the argument is that there's the inference of an innocent explanation was at least as strong as one of a consciousness of guilt. And the instruction itself addresses that concern, and it says, now, as the court will know, it is for you, the jury, to determine from the evidence whether such flight was caused by a consciousness of guilt or by some other innocent motive. So that concern was adequately addressed for the jury.
I understand that. That's very clear from the instruction. My question is, the case law says they're generally disfavored. Doesn't that mean that we should very closely examine the use of such an instruction? And doesn't the argument made by counsel impact whether they're appropriate, even though in some circumstances entirely appropriate, maybe in other circumstances they are not?
As I understand the case law, Your Honor, and the test goes back almost 70 years, that if these factors are met, then disfavored or not, the prosecution is still entitled to that instruction.
What is the meaning then of the phrase they're generally disfavored?
That I think that has to be read in the context of the test, and that they're disfavored unless these factors are met. That's, I guess, would have to be our response, because they are often given, and I think the instruction does adequately handle the concerns. I mean, the disfavored because, as counsel argued, and from the case law, and this was the argument in Larson, as I understand it, is that they tend to favor one aspect of the evidence, but without, flight without the aspects of the instruction would be problematic. And I guess that's what I would think, that the instruction crafted the way it is to address these concerns. Yes, Your Honor.
Do I understand your argument to be that we would reverse in situations where these factors are not met, and that's what disfavored means? And unless these factors are met, the giving of such an instruction would be error. Is that your argument?
Could be error if the test has not been met. Whether it's reversible, of course, depends on the,
okay,
on the prejudice.
But it would certainly be a thumb on the scale, right? But you would have an erroneous instruction, and then we would have to go to the analysis of whether that erroneous instruction was sufficiently prejudicial to result in a reversal, right?
If the four-factor test were not met,
right?
I would have to agree with that. Otherwise, the test is okay. It has little meaning there.
Well, I don't know that sufficiently answers Judge Nieto's question, because we don't have the statement about a whole lot of instructions that they are generally disfavored. That's a pretty strong word, and that word suggests that there is a reason why that at least it suggests to me that they should be given rather sparingly. And am I wrong about that? You said that they were given a lot.
Well, I have seen them when the situation calls for it, I guess.
Okay.
And and again, even whether it was plain or harmless error, and we would suggest under under the argument that's raised on appeal, that it should be plain error, because he's, I mean, the defense is submitting arguments from other jurisdictions that weren't raised below. So, and under Martinez, that's the whole point of raising specific objections to the trial court to consider these things. But whether it's plain or harmless, the evidence was overwhelming. I mean, not just, we had two eyewitnesses, third-party witnesses, that saw the defendant leave the premises for some minutes, return, immediately go and stab the victims. So that makes, you know, it certainly makes the defendant the initial aggressor. There's no self-defense. The prosecution did not argue flight, didn't rely on that concept during closing argument, didn't mention it, so didn't highlight it for the jury. Unless the court has other questions, I ask you to affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Just a few points, Your Honor. The prosecution didn't highlight the flight in closing argument because the prosecution didn't need to. The trial judge had already brought the matter up and instructed the jury on it. I want to address just a few of counsel's comments in the order in which he made them. Going back to the invited error question and the tiered approach where Ms. Alvarado's trial attorney asked for everything and then asked for something in the alternative. That was basically damage control. In other words, if I don't get everything that we believe to be appropriate, then we would request something less than that, only part of it, half a loaf, if not the full loaf of bread. Regarding the singular and the plural and the footnote in the Riley case and the fact that the singular basically means the plural under the statute that says that. That's all well, fine, and good, but unless that's made clear to the jury, it's not going to do much good. If you look at the instructions that were actually given, singular and plural is mixed in there. It goes back and forth, as is the gender of the defendant. At one point, she's referred to as her, then she's referred to as him. It looks like nobody proofread these instructions. That includes my predecessor on this case, as well as the prosecutor and the trial judge. Regarding the flight instruction, going back to that, Mr. First mentioned that the prosecutor didn't refer to it in closing argument, and that's true. He would have been free to do that. But for whatever reason, didn't. Unless there are any other questions from the panel, we would ask that the court reverse the conviction on both of these grounds, as well as consider the other arguments made in the brief and remand this case for a new trial.
Thank you, Mr. Workers.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Mr. First. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.